This is Kindergarten Cop, and it is Wednesday, February 25th, 2026, and I will be reading from the News Gazette today. An article from Unit 4 School District titled Promising Program to Launch at BTW, Goal to Fulfill Equity Aims of Consent Decree by Luke Taylor. Years ago, the Champaign School District made promises to African American students as part of a second revised consent decree. Now, decades and many changes later, a team is coming together to make sure the last of those promises is kept. Imani Bazell gets the credit for coming up with the ideas for a promise zone and promise plans, taking inspiration in part from the Harlem Children's Zone. They were swimming in dough. We have nothing but promises, Bazell said. So we named it the Promise Zone, sort of with the idea of wrapping around a part of town, if you will. Former Unit 4 Superintendent Judy Wiegand tasked Bazell with finding out what parts of the consent decree hadn't been followed through on and, well, following through on them. While the project first got rolling about a decade ago, Bazell stepped away due to illness, and then administration changes and the COVID-19 pandemic took their toll. She said that at this point, the team is starting fresh. This time around, they're getting a place to focus on right away. Booker T. Washington STEM Academy will be the site of the first Promise Zone, thanks to interest and collaboration with recently appointed principal Cecily Thomas. We have a black female principal who's just working her heart out on behalf of kids and families there, and we're saying, girl, we got your back, Bazell said. Aixa Marchand, assistant professor in educational psychology at the University of Illinois, said having someone like Thomas, who is, quote, dynamic and impressive, and a community member herself, made BTW the perfect choice. Her child goes to Booker T. Washington, which for me, as a former teacher, I think that that says so much. Like, this school is good enough for my child, so it's good enough for all children, Marchand said. Marchand is one of several UI faculty members to be involved in the Promise Zone team. Most have ties to education specifically, but it is an interdisciplinary project. Still, the idea isn't for the Promise Zone to be enacted by teachers or team members alone. It's intended as a community project involving families, churches, and more. We are wanting to help Booker T. Washington parents galvanize their own voices and begin to speak for themselves and show leadership in the school and ultimately in the school district, Bazell said. We want to increase the voices of African American parents and community members to really make sure that our schools are always focused on the three E's, equity and excellence and education. Within the Promise Zone will be Promise Plans, which will be individualized plans for students who could use the support. At BTW, they'll start with kindergartners, fourth graders, and fifth graders, but Bazell said the idea is that the plans will follow the students up into and even through college. While performance in school is one aspect to be considered, Promise Plans aim to focus on the students holistically, considering their physical, emotional, spiritual, and intellectual health. This would involve helping kids both in schools and out, and working hand in hand with parents especially, but also counselors and nearly anyone in the community who wants to play a role in helping out. I love the Promise Plans because that really kind of goes with the old saying of, it takes a village to raise a child, and making sure that there are adults who are invested in the well-being of this child, Marchand said. While it's hard to say exactly when the Promise Zone could be considered, quote, created, Bazell said plans are continuing to form, and the team may start working with some first kids as early as over the next few months. She said that a main priority throughout all of this is replicability. Working at BTW is just the start for an initiative that hopefully can spread across other parts of the school district. If one day we do get traction and a student is like, "Will you be on my Promise Plan team?" we want people to know what that means, Marshawn said. And now from Champaign County Court. Trial begins for Mansfield man found asleep with gun. Defense claims it wasn't his firearm, by Luke Taylor. Even though police found a Mansfield man asleep with a gun in his lap, his attorney says he did not unlawfully possess a firearm. Assistant State's Attorney Katie Guffier said in opening arguments that the man who called the police and reported that 34-year-old Justin Beckett fired a gun in the trailer where he was staying was the actual owner of the firearm. Beckett's trial on charges of armed violence, felon possession of a firearm, and possession of meth started Tuesday. Champaign County Sheriff's deputies responded to a mobile home park in Bonneville at around 7:54 a.m. December 23rd, according to testimony from deputies who were on the scene. On scene, they found a man identified as Beckett asleep in a vehicle with a handgun on his lap. Due to concerns about him being armed and his potential mental state upon being woken, the deputies decided to act quickly by breaking the window, removing the firearm from Beckett, and detaining him quickly. While one deputy testified that they all began shouting commands at the defendant as soon as he woke up, attempting to tell him exactly what he needed to do to avoid escalating the situation, he said that Beckett did immediately comply. The van he was asleep in was parked outside of a mobile home that Beckett had visited multiple times throughout the night, according to an individual who was staying there. That man testified that Beckett was searching for the person who actually owned the mobile home and was displaying erratic behavior and mood swings. At one point during the evening, the man said that he, Beckett, and another individual were sitting in the mobile home and talking while Beckett had his handgun in his lap. The man alleged that Beckett picked up the gun and fired it twice, unexpectedly. He described the shots going right by his head, though he didn't believe that Beckett was aiming at him. Investigators found two bullet holes in the wall of the mobile home. The man said he told Beckett to leave immediately after that, but didn't call the police for another 20 or 30 minutes. At that point, he had found that Beckett had fallen asleep in the van out in front of the mobile home. While searching the van, deputies found what was identified as a meth pipe, as well as a bag of methamphetamine. When Beckett himself was searched, a smaller bag of meth was found in the pocket of the coat he was wearing. Guifra said in her opening arguments that the man who made the report had motivation to frame Beckett as possessing the firearm, rather than claim it himself, because he also has prior convictions and had an ongoing case at the time. She said that at the end of the trial, the only charge proved beyond a reasonable doubt will be that Beckett was in possession of meth. Witnesses began to touch on the process of collecting DNA evidence from the firearm and magazines found at the scene Tuesday. Further evidence on that topic, as well as closing arguments, are expected to be presented Wednesday morning, to be followed by jury deliberations. And now an article on the High Speed Rail Alliance training days. Bill would have IDOT plan for hourly Chicago to Champaign rail service. By Jana Wiersma. If residents of Champaign-Urbana are tired of driving over 2 hours plus traffic to get to Chicago, now is the time to let state legislators know. The nonprofit High Speed Rail Alliance, along with state legislators, held a press conference Tuesday morning at the Illinois State Capitol in Springfield to discuss the Passenger Rail Planning Act. The legislation, which has been introduced in both the Illinois House and Senate, would direct the Illinois Department of Transportation to plan for a minimum of hourly service from Chicago to a variety of destinations, including Champaign, the Alliance said. Champaign has so much going for it, and there's so much need to connect to Chicago and O'Hare, said Rick Harnish, executive director of the Alliance. There were only 4 trips from the Windy City to CU on Amtrak's schedule for Tuesday, along with another 4 in the opposite direction. Hourly service would add more convenience for passengers who need to extend their trips by just an hour or make plans at the last minute, Harnish said. You really need hourly services to make riding the train competitive with driving, he said. Under the proposed act, the state would plan to offer hourly service from Chicago to the following destinations: Milwaukee, Madison, Wisconsin to St. Paul, Minnesota, Rockford, East St. Louis to St. Louis to Kansas City, Missouri, Detroit to Toronto, Cleveland, Fort Wayne to Columbus, Indiana, Indianapolis to Cincinnati, Indianapolis to Louisville, to Nashville, to Atlanta, the Northeast Corridor via Amtrak's Acela trains would operate on pulse schedules, with hourly service available between 5 a.m. and 10 p.m. in both directions. The legislature also directs IDOT to plan for certain routes that would run every 2 hours during the same time frame, and others that would run every 4 hours. The latter includes service from Champaign to Carbondale and Memphis, Tennessee. While local leaders have long advocated for Champaign-Urbana to be included as a stop in a proposed high-speed route from Chicago to St. Louis, Harnish said the proposed bill is, quote, purely about frequency and does not specify that the routes would be high-speed. Now, in order to add frequent service, you've got to add a lot of track. So it might make sense to do it as high speed just from the get-go, but the first step is IDOT's got to actually start designing it, he said. Harnish noted that the legislation would not include funding for construction, but is instead focused on getting the state to begin design work so that Illinois will be ready once funding opportunities are available, particularly at the federal level. Additionally, he said that the state will need to work both with the railroad industry and surrounding states to make this plan a reality. We are the center of the Midwest economy, and so we've got a lot of trains coming into Chicago, Harnish said. And we can be a leader on saying, within the state of Illinois, this is where all these trains can run. Harnish is also a member of the state's High Speed Railway Commission, which is conducting a feasibility study for the high-speed rail from Chicago to St. Louis with assistance from IDOT. State officials envision a line with speeds of up to 220 miles per hour compared to Amtrak trains that currently reach up to 110 miles per hour on the existing corridor between the two cities. There are some draft points on potential routings that we've discussed, so we know the basic structure of what the choices are of where the tracks might go, Harnish said. The consultant right now is doing some estimates on ridership and revenue, which then gets fed into some benefit calculators. There's choices to be made that the legislature needs to make, and I'm hoping this year we have a really good report that helps. When asked if Champaign is included in some of the potential routes, he replied that it is. The fastest of them would essentially start at McCormick Place, go down the lakefront, and then at a point between University Park and Kankakee, make almost a straight line south until you get to a place that's between Danville and Champaign, he said. And then the trains would turn west to go to Champaign, and then Decatur, Springfield, and St. Louis. The other is, and we need to discuss all options, right? The other is to put it in I-57 and have it run down I-57. And this photo includes a screenshot of the proposed frequencies in HB 4279 and SB3285. According to High Speed Rail Alliance, the proposed Passenger Rail Planning Act would direct the Illinois Department of Transportation to plan for a minimum of hourly service in several strategic corridors, including Chicago to Champaign. Now, from our communities section, this is an article titled A Highly Anticipated Hangout. Smoke Lab Lounge's grand opening set for 1 p.m. Thursday by Jennifer Bailey. The first cannabis consumption lounge in Danville and second in Vermilion County, preceded by Molly's Joint in Tolono, is officially opening for business. Seven Points Smoke Lab Lounge, which previously had a one-day trial on Christmas Day, followed by a soft opening over the course of several weeks, will have a grand opening and ribbon-cutting ceremony at 1 p.m. Thursday at the dispensary, 380 Eastgate Drive. Seven Points CEO Brad Zerman said the lounge name came from him driving by other businesses with lab in their name, such as a coffee lab and stretch lab. Zerman said he wanted to incorporate the lounge to being like a lab, with 7 Points' tagline being, "Come experiment with weed and music." Zerman said the business is on OpenTable, the online seat reservation service, which people can use to reserve cannabis vendor-sponsored tables, booths, and a couch corner at the Smoke Lab. "We have a full stage here," Zerman said about live music and events. "The venue has stage lights and all the equipment, including microphones, monitors, and public address system for karaoke and other events. We have everything that a band really needs to plug into. They just need their instruments," Zerman said. The lab has hosted about 5 acts so far, he said. Alex Ziegler, who sings and plays acoustic guitar and also works at 7 Point, has played on the lounge stage a couple times already and says the venue is, quote, "more focused and more attentive on the act instead of turning the person or band into the background noise in a bar." "It's super cool," he said about being on the stage. "It's a culture club. That's what we're trying to do here. There's nothing like it around here." Ziegler said, "It's more like a family vibe, like, quote, friends getting around a campfire, basically." The lounge also features a variety of snacks and drinks for sale, including some hemp drinks as well as cannabis products. Also, bongs and pipes are available for people to try for free in the lounge, and games are available to play to add to the fun, Zerman said. Zerman said he plans to offer more food options in the future by building a kitchen where a temporary outside seating patio is now located with cornhole sets. Under city ordinance, cannabis users can't smoke outside on the open patio, but only in the lounge building. He adds that they have an air filtration system in the lounge for those who don't like the cannabis smoke smell staying on them. 7 Point opened 2 years ago in April, setting itself apart from other cannabis dispensaries by focusing on music and also being a vinyl record store. Zerman said business is good and we're growing steadily. This month has been its busiest month to date, which he said is fairly unusual in the cannabis business in the middle of winter. December usually is the biggest month, with November right behind it at the holiday time, he said. We will see how it all shakes out in the end, he said, adding that there were a couple really bad weather weekends in January. Zerman wanted to provide a safe place to smoke for groups of people with the lounge addition. Zerman has said, "We aim to create a collaborative ambiance that not only promotes responsible consumption, but also highlights the cultural and social aspects of cannabis consumption, where a wide selection of consumption devices, from high-tech vaporizers to glass bongs to rolling papers, will be available to use at no charge. People are buying cannabis all over the place, but it's a whole other story when you want to try to use it," he said, about people smoking at home and in their cars. This article is from Rich Miller, Capital Facts. Pritzker's new budget plan not pleasing to teachers' unions. As expected, we did not see a whole lot of spending increases in Governor J.B. Pritzker's state budget proposal last week. Last year, Pritzker said his budget limited increase in discretionary spending to less than 1 percentage point. The plan unveiled last week limits that increase to less than a half a point. An education funding lobby day was held the day before the budget address in Springfield. Teacher unions decried the state for not living up to its evidence-based funding law, which was supposed to bring all schools to 90% adequate funding levels by next year. Instead, the annual funding ramp is way behind, and the unions say the state won't reach its target until 2034. So, they claim, the state owes K-12 schools $5 billion and higher education another $1 billion. And, as they've been demanding for a while, they want it all now. Pritzker's budget proposal does raise spending on mandated categoricals for K-12 schools, things like special education, transportation, and school lunches by $51 million, which the governor's office says benefits all districts. But the governor's plan will raise the annual funding plan ramp payment increase by just $5 million to $305 million. Higher education spending will be limited to a 1% increase, similar to last year and way behind inflation. The day before the governor delivered his proposed budget to lawmakers, rumors circulated among legislators that K-12 education would get an additional $200 million. Some people assumed that money would be used to boost the state's evidence-based funding law. The governor's budget proposal did indeed project $200 million in revenues from imposing a new social media platform fee, and the money was earmarked for education. But, as I noted above, evidence-based funding was given only an additional $5 million on top of its mostly usual $300 million annual increase. According to a presentation from the governor's budget office, that $200 million, if approved, and if the fee survives a legal challenge, would be dedicated to supporting education. My associate, Isabel Miller, asked Pritzker during his post-address press conference where that $200 million would go. Well, guess what? The legislature has a lot to say about how the money would be spent, but I think the important thing is that our education system, our K-12 system across the state, needs that kind of support, Pritzker said. Then he moved on before she could follow up. But wait, this is Pritzker's own budget proposal, and all the revenues from that new fee are included in his spending plan. The governor's budget wouldn't balance without it. So, I followed up with the governor's office to ask where, specifically, that money was going. The proposal is to deposit it into the Common School Fund, the same place the lottery is deposited, to support the cost of K-12 education, Pritzker's office said. The Common School Fund is one of the general funds, so the deposit is reflected in the general fund's budget proposal. Okay, but according to the governor's budget book, the Common School Fund is expected to grow by $103 million in the coming fiscal year, roughly half of the $200 million it's receiving. And the lottery's contribution is projected to grow by $17 million to $832 million out of a $6.96 billion fund budget. Ironically, this sort of thing used to happen with the lottery all the time. The gambling cash didn't really add new money to school funding, but it did help the state shift an equal amount away to the rest of the budget every year. In this case, $200 million is being added to the school fund, but in the process, $114 million appears to have been shifted out of the fund to the rest of the budget. Pritzker held a news conference Friday to tout his new proposal to ban mobile phones in classrooms. afterward, the Illinois Federation of Teachers had seen enough and issued a sharply critical statement. What educators will tell you is that creating more unfunded mandates while failing to fund the ones already on the books, special education, nutritional supports for hungry children, and school transportation, is out of order, Cindy Oberly-Don, the union's executive vice president, said in a news release. The state of Illinois owes its students $6 billion for pre-K to PhD, and that is where the governor should start. From girls' high school basketball, postseason roundup, from Normal by Joey Wright. A historic season for the Champaign Central girls' basketball team ended on Tuesday night as the third-seeded Maroons lost 71-58 to top-seeded Decatur MacArthur in a Class 3A sectional semifinal game at Normal West. Central, which won its first Class 3A regional title since 2010 last Friday night, led 18-13 after the first quarter before falling behind 32-29 at halftime. The Maroons' 14 wins were their most since 2022. From Pontiac, Mantino upends St. Joseph Ogden. St. Joseph Ogden's bid for its first Class 2A sectional plaque ended with a 44-23 loss to Mantino in a Class 2A sectional semifinal in Pontiac. Emily Horath led Mantino, now one win away from its first ever sectional title, with 19 points, while Maddie Geske chipped in 18 points as well. The Spartans' final record of 20-11 marked the team's best mark since the 2021-2022 season, when the team finished 24-8 and won a Class 2A regional title. Top-seeded Mantino will face Pontiac, which bested Bishop McNamara 46-32 on the other side of the bracket for a sectional title. Cisna Park upset by Hayworth. From Gilman, Cisna Park's streak of Class 1A state finals appearances drew to a close on Tuesday night in Gilman. The top-seeded Timberwolves senior class, which had ended the last two basketball seasons and last three volleyball seasons at CEFCU Arena in Normal, marked its final basketball game with a 54-35 loss to second-seeded Hayworth in a Class 1A sectional semifinal at Iroquois West. Cisna Park, 26-2, was outscored 18-0 in the final 8 minutes of play, as the Hornets advance within one win of their first sectional title since 2017.